All right, we're in 2 Samuel chapter 18 this morning. 2 Samuel chapter 18. For the benefit of those who haven't been with us all the time, we've been going through the books of 1 and now 2 Samuel. And we've worked our way up to 2 Samuel chapter 18. Just to get a little bit of the overview context, in 2 Samuel chapter 15, we get the rebellion of Absalom. Okay, Absalom begins to steal the heart of the people. Then he goes and declares himself to be king. He amasses a large crowd, comes against David. David makes the strategic decision that rather than fight right there fighting his family, but he wasn't prepared. He made the decision that the best thing to do to protect his family and hopefully preserve the country was for him just to evacuate Jerusalem and leave. They did. He left a couple of friendly priests there to be his eyes and ears, sending messages. And in fact, they sent a message that Ahithophel had given extremely wise but extremely brutal in counsel against him. That is, let me go now and take him out. And he had left, he had sent Hushai. Hushai agreed to go, and Hushai gave opposing counsel. And in the providence of God, Hushai's counsel was followed. He said, now, wait a minute. You know David and his men, they're mighty men. There is a bear robbed of their whelps. They're going to be chafed in their minds. We don't need to rush into this thing. But if we gather an overwhelming force, then we'll go out. It doesn't matter if they find the strongest city in the country. We'll take ropes. We'll pull the walls down. We'll drag the whole city into the river. Yeah, that's great. Let's do it. Well, that gave David time to recoup. So David made it as far as Mahanaim. Now, that city has come up a few times before. Most notably, that came up after Saul and Jonathan and the other three sons were killed. Ishbosheth and Abner went to Mahanaim. Okay, Mahanaim is on the, if I look at it from your direction, if we got the Sea of Galilee here, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, Mahanaim is on the east side, up a little further north, near in the direction of the Sea of Galilee. Okay, but it was on the east side. As Israel was coming towards the Promised Land, you remember they captured Sihon and Og. They captured some of the enemies, and a couple of the tribes said, hey, we want this land right here. We don't want to go over the river into the other land. We want this land right here. Well, that's the territory that we're talking about. Gilead, that vicinity, okay, on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And so Mahanaim would have been in that general region. It showed up more than once, but David, when he fled from Jerusalem, went towards the Jordan. He got the message, hey, don't wait, cross the Jordan tonight. They crossed the Jordan, and in the daylight, they made their way north up the Jordan Valley and made it as far as Mahanaim. There were some men that met him there. We found that in the end of chapter 17, verse 24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. That's kind of a summary statement there, all right? There's a lot of time that goes into that. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son, whose name was Ithrah, an Israelite, that went into Abigail, daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So Amasa and Joab are cousins, all right? That's the point of this little section right here. Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. It came to pass when David was come to Mahanaim that Shobi, the son of Nahash, of Rabbah, of the children of Ammon, and Maker, the son of Amiel, of Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, of Rogalim. All right, we've got three men here that met David. And verse 28, they brought supplies, beds, basins, earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched corn, etc. Okay, but you got three men that also kind of represent three groups of people. See, the first one there is Shobi, the son of Nahash, of Rabbah, of the children of Ammon. Okay, you have an Ammonite. You have a foreigner. These are the same people that cut off half the beard and cut off half the garment of David's messengers to humiliate him. They'd gone to fight a war against them. You remember that story. Okay, one of the princes or wealthy men there had gravitated towards David and away from the Ammonites. You have the Ammonites, a foreigner. Then you have Machir, a son of Amiel of Lodabar. That represents Saul's family. He this guy right here is the one that had harbored Mephibosheth. He's the one that allowed Mephibosheth to live with him and fed him and took care of him. Okay? And then you have Barzillai the Gileadite would have been an Israelite, a wealthy landowner. And you see that sometimes God gave men means so that they could meet a specific need. I mean, these men had extra beds and basins and vessels, and they had extra wheat and corn and barley and those kind of things. I mean, and when the need presented itself, they were willing to give and to share. But God had put these men, but it also was an encouragement to David because he could see that, I mean, what's he supposed to think? There's a huge number coming with Absalom. Okay? The whole country's turned against me. Now what do I do? I mean, that's the natural thoughts, right? And so here God is encouraging him. He is giving him, Psalms calls it a token for good. Show me a token for good. God gave him a visible token that, number one, God hadn't forgotten about him. Number two, God hasn't forsaken him. Number three, God can still take care of him. He had needs that he had no way to meet. He was the king. He was used to being the one that had all supplies. He's on the run. He's got nothing. And so God met his needs. God encouraged him. And God took care of him. All right, now you see, remember we read there in verse 24, David came to Mahanaim and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. All right, chapter 18, verse 1. And David numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. All right, chapter 18, we're just going to call them, I tried to come up with a fancy title, but I couldn't, okay? So we're just going to call this the death of Absalom. All right, that's what happens here in chapter 18. But how much time is involved in 1724 and 18:1? Not sure. You know, some of the historians and commentators think that there was a period of weeks here. Okay? Now, Hushai's counsel to Absalom was, let all Israel be gathered generally from Dan to Beersheba, from north to south. Okay? Let's go. Now, in that day, you don't put it out on the internet. You don't put it on the 6 o'clock breaking news, you know, that the message was sent how? Word of mouth, okay? Maybe on horseback, maybe on, you know, other animals. But the bottom line is it would have taken some time for the call to go out. Now, these men were not a part of a standing army, okay? This wasn't the Roman army that, you know, their salary was paid for them to be on call all the time, or even like our full-time military. For the most part, these were farmers, shepherds. These were businessmen, okay? But when the call went out for their country, they would go, but they also had in the back of their mind, I've got a period of time, then I've got to get back to my responsibilities, all right? So bear that in mind as we get further down in chapter 18. But the call went out from all Israel to be gathered generally from Dan to Beersheba. How long did that take? I don't know. I think it was more than a day or two, okay? It was 2 or 3 days' journey to get to the northern extremities. And then if they're going to not only gather their weapons, but gather some supplies and bring those, it could conceivably have been a couple weeks. Okay? And it could have been several weeks. I mean, speed is of the essence here. But if it was a week or two, it would not surprise me. That's what I'm saying. Okay? So with that in mind, while there are some that are gathering with Absalom, there are others who are gathering with David. See, there are people that are making the choices here, making decisions. But not only were there some that were with David, but the ones that were with David, the only number that we have is 600. Okay? You got the 600 that were with David. Okay? That's the only number that we have for sure. Other than that, we don't know how many were with David in Jerusalem, but it wouldn't have been tens of thousands. Okay? So, if David's going to set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, there are others who were not in Jerusalem who have found the location where David is headquartering, and they've gone to offer their services to their king, to King David. All right? So, chapter 18, verse 1, David numbered the people that were with him. That's the first point here in chapter 18 is David prudently organizes his army. David numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. But the people answered, Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us, neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore now it is better that thou succor us out of the city. Okay, so you see the organization here. Generally speaking, if you had a ground campaign like this, there would be three divisions. I mean, this isn't an all the time, but it's just, you know, in general terms. You have a main thrust in the center, you have a right flank, you have a left flank. Okay? So from that standpoint, three divisions make some sense. There were times when David divided them in two, some around the front, some around the back. Okay? It's not an all the time rule, but there's reasons for that. But also, we've got Joab and Abishai. If you've been paying attention through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll recognize those names. Okay? They are cousins of David's. Okay? Either cousins or nephews, depending on the relationship of Zeruiah to Jesse, okay, and David. But nonetheless, they're cousins. And we've seen those names before. They were obviously men of war. Whatever we want to say about Joab's character, and there's not a ton great that we can say there other than that he was loyal, that Joab was a very, very astute military man. Strategically, he was sharp. I mean, we don't have any record of a battle that Joab went into that he just had terrible strategy and he got wiped out. Now, part of that's because God had given him a military mind. Part of that is because he was on the side of David and God was blessing David. I understand that too. But what I'm saying is Joab's very sharp. He's the captain of the host. Okay? Then you have Abishai, his brother. Abishai was one of David's mighty men. Okay? We have a list a little bit later on of total of 36 or 7 mighty men. Abishai was one of those mighty men. Interestingly enough, Joab was not. That's a story for another chapter. But Joab and Abishai, but then the third captain was Ittai the Gittite. Okay? Now, Gittite, what does that tell us about where he came from? Did he come from Git?
No.
He's from Gath. All right. Normally, you can take the "ite" off the end of it and kind of figure out where they come. It doesn't work this time. Okay, but he was from Gath, one of the five royal cities of the Philistines. Okay, so he is one who has defected. Now, remember when David fled for a time and tried to seek asylum with the Philistines when he was running away from Saul? Where'd he go? Achish, king of Gath, and then Achish gave him his own city, Ziklag. All right. But this would have been in the area where David had some influence and some testimony during the time he was in the land of the Philistines. So it doesn't surprise us from a human standpoint if someone from there thought enough of David that he would want to come and be a part of his army. Maybe he was also sympathetic to Israel's God as well. But nonetheless, you have Ittai the Gittite. Now, in chapter 15, when David is leaving Jerusalem rather than stand right there and fight Absalom, Ittai is part of the ones that are in the procession coming out saying, I'm with the king. David says to him, what are you doing? You just came. You don't need to go out with me. It gives the impression that it hadn't been that long since he defected and came over to Israel, or relocated, if you want to say it that way. But Ittai makes the statement, you're my king. Wherever my king is, that's where I'm going to be. Okay? Wherever you are, that's where I'm going to go. And David said, all right, fine. You come with me. Now, we also have, as we read the end of chapter 17, that we had Shobi, who was from the people of Ammon. He was an Ammonite. Okay, so there are some in the army of David that are foreigners, if we could say it that way. They're not Israelites. And I don't know, maybe it didn't happen this way, but maybe it did. It would make some sense if Ittai's men would have been under him, and maybe some of the other foreign fighters would have been placed under Ittai. And then you got the Israelites who don't necessarily want to be fighting under a Philistine, a man of Gath. All right, you're going to put them under Joab and Abishai and under familiar leaders. Okay? Nonetheless, he's got men who are valiant men. He's got men who are warriors. They're skilled at this. Okay, this is one of the advantages that David has. Okay, Absalom is going to try to overwhelm him with numbers. David is far outclassing him in years of experience and in a lot of ways in tenacity. Okay, they know they are fighting for their lives. And so David divides out the army. You got a third with Joab, a third with Abishai, and a third with Ittai. And then David said, look, I'm going to go with you. And they said, no, you're not. No, you're not. It was the right thing for him to do. From the standpoint of leadership, it was the right thing for him to do. He should have, from a leadership standpoint, we ought never to ask someone to do something we're not willing to do ourselves. There are things that I'm not really capable of doing that other people have abilities. They're a lot better at it than me. Okay? And there are times when I may say, hey, can you do this for me? You're a lot better at it than I am. Okay? But I should still be willing to say, hey, I'm willing to do it. And no matter where we are as a station in life, we should be willing to do whatever. David was willing to say, look, I'm not asking you to go put your life on the line while I stay here. I'm willing to go too. Now, they also recognized, from a strategic standpoint, that if this is a game of chess, the king's what matters. Okay? If the pawns and the rooks and some of the other pieces get knocked off, it's not a game changer. The king gets knocked off, game over. Okay? They recognize that. And they said, look, you're worth 10,000 of us. Now, people want to speculate based on verse number 3. It says, they will not care for us if half of us die, but you're worth 10,000. So some people want to speculate and say that 10,000 was half their army, so they had 20,000 people. That's not exact. I mean, I can't say for sure that's what that means. Okay? But if you'll look at the number 10,000 in Scripture, a lot of times that's the biggest number you're going to find. I mean, in Revelation, it's 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. Okay? So, I mean, if we were going to say it, we might say it, you're worth a million of us. Because that's kind of the biggest, we want to throw out a big number. That's what we would throw out, right? But nonetheless, they said, look, David, you're not going here. But they also said, therefore now it is better, into verse 3, that thou succor us out of the city. In other words, you stay here with the reserve troops. And then, if we get in trouble, you can bring the reserves and reinforce the part of the battle that most needs it. All right? Yeah, that makes sense. I'll respect your wishes. And David did that. But we see here David prudently organizes his army. It is, he put the right leaders in place. He put the right organization in place and the right plan. Okay? If you're Absalom, I mean, Absalom already, he's not a military tactician. We know that already. But Absalom is operating on a basis of pride, arrogance, assumption, and he's going to assume, David's not coming out after me. He knows better than that. If he's smart, he'll try to get as far away as possible. So when Joab goes out and they attack the other army, they're going to gain the element of surprise. Okay? But when David ran away from Saul, when Joab and Abishai and some of these men were with him, guess where they were? All up and down this part of the country. I mean, they know this part of the country inside and out. They're very familiar with it. We could tell stories of how in certain of the Revolutionary War battles and some of the others, how the advantage was gained by those who knew the terrain and used it to their advantage. Well, that's basically David and his men in that standpoint are fighting on a home field advantage. We have the organization of the army. Then I want you to see with me number 2. Let's snag a couple more verses here first. Verse 4, and the king said unto them, what seemeth you best I will do. The king stood by the gate, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, the three captains, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave captains charge concerning Absalom. Okay? Deal gently with the young man for my sake. Okay, it means exactly what you think it means. It means gentle, to show gentleness. Now, this is a highly unusual request. Okay? I want you to go out there and I want you to win the battle, but I want you to be really nice to their commanding officer. Say what? You know, I want you to go out there and I want you to whip them. I mean, let's put it in football terms. I want you to go out there and I want you to whip them, but don't touch the quarterback. What? You know, it, from a military standpoint, it makes no sense. But everybody knew exactly what was going on. This is David's son. And again, this is part of the reason they loved David, was because of his heart. Even if they look at this and go, strategically, I don't know if this is a good idea. Okay? But it says all the people heard. Whether David spoke loud enough that all the people could hear, or those that heard it from David's mouth passed the message back down the line, everybody understood the orders. Okay? Number two, we see that David prudently organized his army. Number two, we see God providentially arrests Absalom. I love this part. Verse number six, so the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men, for the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. This is awesome. It really is. Okay? God providentially arrests Absalom. Okay? If we had an arrest report, the arresting officer would be God, and the assisting officer would be the oak tree. Okay? So, that's basically what we have here. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. Okay? Where's that? Nobody can tell us for sure. Okay? The best fix that I can get on it is based on a story out of Judges 12. Okay? Judges 12, you remember Jephthah's vow? Jephthah said, God, if you'll give me the victory, I'll offer as a sacrifice the first thing that comes out. He ended up sacrificing his daughter. He didn't have to do that. That's another story. But that's in Judges 11. Judges chapter 12, the men of Ephraim came and they were fighting just like brothers, just like cousins. They're fighting to Jephthah and said, you went out and fought and you didn't include us. You made us look bad. You made us look like slackers. You left us at home. And Jephthah says, no, I didn't. I sent out the call and you didn't come and I had to go. I didn't have time to wait on you. And there's this back and forth. Well, then Jephthah takes his men that he already has together and they go over into the land of Gilead and they chase the men of Ephraim. Now, the inheritance of Ephraim was on the main part of Israel, okay? It was on the western side of Jordan, between Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, okay? There, the way I understand it, Ephraim's inheritance was in the middle section, a little north of Jerusalem, but in the middle part of the country. I mean, later on, they went to Joshua and said, you gave us too small a piece. Joshua said, fine. This is in Joshua chapter 17. Joshua said, fine, go up to the mountains up north, cut down the wood, knock out the giants, you can have that land too. And some of them did that, okay? But there, what I'm saying is Ephraim's land was in the main part. This battle, for whatever reason, took place on the other side of Jordan in this general vicinity we're talking about. And so they killed a whole lot of the men of Ephraim. And then they retreated as far as the fords of Jordan, it says. And some of you will remember this. When somebody came and tried to cross, they said, are you of Ephraim? And they said, no. They said, say Shibboleth. And some of them could say it, some of them couldn't. The ones that the Ephraimites said Sibboleth, that little bit of a tick or a lisp or some sort of a peculiarity to their speech. And that was the test they used to figure out, are you really from Ephraim or not? And they captured men at the crossing, the fords of Jordan, and put a lot of them in. All right. So my best guess is where this battle took place on the eastern side of Jordan, that's referred to as the Wood of Ephraim. Because we know that Mahanaim is on the east side of Jordan. We know that from the end of chapter 17, Absalom and his men have crossed Jordan following David. This battle happens on the east side of Jordan. Okay, so it can't be in the actual land of Ephraim. So best guess, Wood of Ephraim. Okay, verse number 7, the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was a great slaughter. And verse 8 says that the wood devoured more people than the sword. If you read the accounts of people who have been to the Bible lands, okay, they're incredible, very picturesque. But in certain parts, all of the land of Israel is pretty much rocky. Okay? It's very little flat space, lots of hills. But you got to understand, Mahanaim is in the general vicinity of the Jordan River, not looking down at the water, but in the general vicinity. When you get to Israel, the Jordan River is in a very deep valley, okay? And there's a very steep decline out around a lot of the edges, okay? Not only that, when you get near a river, what is the general description of the land, okay? Generally, the water kind of slopes towards the river. It's not just like flat, 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 boom, river, okay? I mean, right here, there's land that kind of slopes towards the river just, a quarter mile up the road here. There, and you get, in big picture terms, you have a watershed, and there's generally high spots, and then water kind of runs towards the rivers and the bays and the low spots. But what I'm saying is that as the rain waters would make their way towards the Jordan, this part of the country, there are a lot of gullies and ravines that have been cut, some by the water flow, just rough land, okay? The one man whose account I read said that they couldn't, he was on a horse and traveling this area and said you couldn't go more than a very brief canter and then you had to pull up and stop or else you'd be down in a ravine that you couldn't see until you're right up on the edge of it. Everything looks great. Whoa, there's a drop-off right here. Okay? Very rough terrain. Okay? If you've got time to take a hike, you're just taking your time, enjoying things, or, you're on your way to get somewhere, you can take a cautious route. If you're running to or from a battle, you don't have time to be as choosy, and that's what would happen. They'd be running, and all of a sudden, boom, where I'm tumbling down the hill. I mean, somebody's running with a sword in their hand. Your mom always tells you not to run with a fork, right? You run with a sword in your hand, you tumble down the hill, bad things happen. And so the wood devoured more people than the sword that day. Again, God in His providence defending David. But you got the battle scattered out. It's a land of this was a forest. Now, we don't always think of Israel as being forest. We think of a lot of it being desert. But in this particular section, east side of Jordan, there was a good number of trees. It's called a wooded area, ravines, gullies, rough terrain, and that's where the battle's taking place. Verse 9 just says, Absalom met the servants of David. Where and how did he meet them? Not sure. Okay? Now, I'm not aware of any other description right off the top of my head where the king was in battle riding a mule. Now, the king's mule, the white mule, okay, was a sign of royalty, and that would be used in peacetime. I'm not remembering right off the top of my head any other description of this in wartime. But this ground, from the description of it, was too rough for chariots. Maybe he was riding a mule. Maybe he wasn't quite ready for the battle, and he got surprised. Normally, they'd ride the mules to the staging area and then take different transportation, but nonetheless, Absalom is riding the mule for whatever reason. He's riding the mule, and Absalom met the servants of David. And it just says, the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak. All right? So if you're reading that, you're like, okay, why did he not have time to remedy this situation? Okay? The clue is in the first phrase of verse 9, Absalom met the servants of David. Okay? He saw the servants of David. So once he saw them and realized the predicament he was in, he wasn't just on, a nice leisurely ride. He was trying to get everything he could possibly get out of a mule, which is an amusing picture in and of itself. But, this is not a horse, it's a mule. He's trying to get all the effort out of this mule that he can. And if he gets spooked, if he gets scared, he scares the animal. Mules have a mind of their own anyway. But in fright and in fear, they're going to even more so have a mind of their own. So the mule takes off, and he's going right under the thick boughs of a great oak, the Scripture says. Now, I don't know if everybody, how many of you have, but I'm sure many of you have had this experience, either on a tractor or riding a lawnmower or something like that, where you're coming up and you're like, oh, I can make it, And, or, the limbs are a little bit low, so you try to ease up there, put your foot on the pedal, or the lever, depending on what kind of tractor you got, and you try to lift it up and scoot under, and then you slip, and it's like, okay? Well, now I'm getting smacked in the face with these limbs. You can kind of picture what's going on here. Well, Well, what happened is the mule goes right under the thick boughs of a great oak. And not, I've heard preachers say he got hung by his hair and it was his long hair that was a sign of rebellion. Okay? Maybe. That's not what it says. Let's just look at what the Scripture says. His head caught hold of the oak. Now, in English and in Hebrew, there's two different words for hair and head. Okay? The word here is head. Now, is your hair on your head? Yeah. Okay. So, well, for some of us anyway. But nonetheless, he got caught by his head. So it could have been that as a part of this entanglement, his hair is all wrapped up. But it could just as easily have been that mule ran him straight into the tree, and in the providence of God, bonk, his neck is stuck in a V, and he's rammed up in there. Okay? And then the Scripture says, and the mule kept going. Hey, come back here. That mule's not coming back. Okay? He's literally suspended between heaven and earth. Notice the description here. His head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth. That's almost like cartoons, isn't it? Wile E. Coyote, Roadrunner, you can see this. You know, the trap sprung. He's hanging, you know, feet dangling. For the life of him, he can't do anything. He's hung in that oak, taken up between heaven and earth, and the mule that was under him went away. More than one commentator picked up on this thought. I'll admit it's not original with me. But they both said that the imagery here is striking. He was rejected by heaven and by earth. He was suspended in the middle, in between them, and that's where he died. You know, but his head got lodged. I mean, I've wondered, okay, he was supposed to be in battle. If he got caught by his hair, did he not have a sword or a machete, give himself a haircut, and cut himself loose? Okay, now if his neck's wedged in there, and there's that fear that, either, well, number one, he may be choking to death, but beyond that, you know, if he feels something weird when he tries to get loose, he's like, okay, I'm going to break my neck. If I move, I better hold still. You know, the panic of the moment, he's suspended between heaven and earth. All of us, from the minute we begin reading this story, look at this rebel Absalom and go, that boy needs a good whipping. And then he goes and he amasses men at Hebron and he rebels against his dad, and his dad defers rather than have a fight right there. And boy, he humiliates his dad's concubines. He declares himself to be king. He makes an irreparable break between himself and his father. And we're like, oh, this boy just needs to get it. God doesn't always work on our time frame. But God has a line, and he says, you can go this far and no more. And Absalom has hit the line where God said, that's it, buddy. That's as far as you're going. And God, in his time, said, boom. End of the line for you, buddy. You stop right here. Guess what? He did get it. He got it. He ended in disgrace. We see here, God providentially arrests Absalom. Number three, we see Joab presumes to disobey David. Verse number 10, a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanging an oak. And Joab said unto the man that told him, behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. The indication there, 10 shekels of silver is a monetary reward. But the girdle most likely would have been a sign of rank. I mean, we go on into chapter 19 and 20. Joab is demoted by David. Amasa is promoted to captain of the host in his stead. And it says, Amasa had on Joab's garment. Okay? There was some sort of a garment that indicated that he was the commander. Just like we have uniforms and stripes and insignias to indicate rank, they did too. So likely this girdle would have been a rank, if you will. He would have given him a promotion to have his own little group, whether it be a captain of 10 or captain of 100 or whatever. Joab said, look, I'd have given you a reward and a promotion. Verse 12, this man knew Joab, but he also had respect for the law of God. Verse number 12, the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise I should have wrought falsehood against mine own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest set thyself against me. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. I don't have time to waste with you. And he took 3 darts in his hand, and thrust them through the heart of Absalom, while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men that bare Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. You see here, Joab presumes to disobey David. Okay? There's two ways to look at this. And I must admit, part of me is torn. Because I look at this thing and go, as long as Absalom is alive, it's never over. Okay? And from a military standpoint, that is the case. As long as Absalom's alive, this whole scenario is not going to go away. But who was the commander? Who was the king? Okay? The man said, look, I heard what the king said, and if I had disobeyed, you would have marched me to David, you'd have been the prosecuting attorney and the executioner. I've seen this game before. I'm not going to put myself out there like that. And so Joab said, I don't want to waste time talking to you. But you understand, there was the other principle was the king gave a clear order. Joab was probably the only one in the army who felt enough stature, if you will, to challenge him. Now, you remember, David used Joab to have Uriah killed. Right? Ever since then, Joab, you know, he was already a conniving man, but now he really feels like he has the leverage over David. It's like, what's David going to do to me? I mean, he's a murderer. He had me kill Uriah. This guy needs to go. I understand this, and I'm the commander of the army, and from a military standpoint, this guy needs to go. Joab presumed to make a decision that was not his to make. Now, God used this scenario to judge Absalom. All right? Remember, Absalom laid a trap for Amnon. And he told his servants, when I give the word, you kill Amnon and don't worry about it. I'll take care of the, you know, I'll take the responsibility for it. Absalom gave the order. Amnon was killed right there at the feast. Here, Joab thrust three darts through him. What was it? Was it what we would think of? It's obviously not the game of darts. Is it what we would think of as an arrow? Possibly. It also could have been a more crude weapon that was just basically a stick that had been shaved down on one end, and then they would put it in the fire to harden it. So basically, it's a wooden arrow instead of a metal arrow, if you will. So you got a shaved down point. Okay? It says he put it through his heart. That term can also just, you know, refer to your abdomen here, all right? So did he stuck those three darts through his chest while he was still alive. And then 10 young men that bear Joab's armor. So either Joab just grabbed three darts, that was the closest thing at hand, and he ran, or he did that for the intention of being cruel. Because the 10 young men that bear Joab's armor were there, they had better weapons. I mean, they had the swords and the arrows and the knives and all of the other weapons of war. They had them there. But what he did was he put three darts and then he backed off and said, fellas, you know what to do. And the 10 men circled around Absalom and tormented him to death. Okay? Gruesome scene. But the scripture says, be sure your sin will find you out. Right? Scripture says that the rebel will die being rejected. Proverbs chapter 3, I believe it is, says, shame shall be the promotion of fools. And God saw to it that Absalom reaped exactly what he had sown. He died a cruel death at the hands of a scrupulous enemy, and there's nothing he could do about it. All right? He's dead. Now notice what they did with him. Verse 17, they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood, and the literal rendering there is literally the great pit in the wood. Okay? Now, did it become the great pit because it became Absalom's grave? I think that's probably what happened. Okay? But there was a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him, and all Israel fled everyone to his tent. You notice here, Absalom is buried in a grave of shame. Okay? He did not receive the burial of kings. We go on, we won't have time to get to it today, but verse 18, 19, 20, it talks about the monument that Absalom had set up for himself in the king's dale. the valley of Kidron there. Likely that was to be his tomb, his monument that he'd set up for himself. And he was to have a state burial, if you will. That's where he assumed he would be. He died, they cut him down from the tree, they threw him in a pit, and they raised a great heap of stones over him. Can you think of anybody else in the Old Testament that they raised a great heap of stones over him when they buried him? How about Achan? Yeah. Okay. He got the same burial that Achan did, a burial of shame and of disgrace. The historians tell us that when people go by either this pit in the woods or even what is thought to be Absalom's monument, they all pick up a stone and cast it and curse the rebel. That's the death of a rebel. Absalom died a death of shame. They didn't even take the body back to his dad so his dad could give it a quote-unquote proper burial. He's buried in a pit in the woods. Understand, this is the end of a rebel. Even if it looks like for a time the rebel is getting away with it, we never get away with it forever. No rebel will get away with it forever. It's just that God doesn't always work on our time frame. Now, let's turn around the other way. David looks like, I've repented, I'm right with God the best that I can be, I'm trying to do what I can now, and now all this trouble is coming into my life. Guess what? God didn't forsake David. God took care of David's enemies. He took them out. He restored David to the throne. David had a number of years left. God doesn't forsake his own either. And God, in His providence, can bring both of those lines of thought together at the exact same time. We can't. I tend to focus on one thing or the other. God brings all of these things together at the same time for His purpose. The death of Absalom, he died a shameful death, the death of a rebel, and packaged in that is also the judgment of God. This is another part of David's spanking. The fourfold death, this is the third payment. And then God is restoring David to the throne of Israel. We serve a great God.